Square dancing was once a pillar of small-town life in Appalachia.
Dance, you be square!
And join your hands and circle up big, serve it to the left and you don't be late. Swing your partner high and low.
That's Phil Jamison calling a Texas star square dance. Phil is a nationally known dance caller, old-time musician, and flatfoot dancer. And he's journeyed into the past to tell the story of Southern Appalachian dance and its many forms. His new book is called Hoedowns, Reels, and Frolics. And Phil Jamison is also the coordinator of Warren Wilson's Appalachian Music Program and joins us now. Hello, Phil.
Yes, hello.
You start by giving us a bit of the history of Southern Appalachian dance, its origins. It comes from many places, does it not?
Yes, it's definitely a hybrid dance form. People often think of it as some kind of ancient Anglo-Celtic heritage, but in fact, there's Black influence, there's Cherokee influence, there's French influence, there's all kinds of other things in the mix, and it's truly a melting pot dance.
And it's homemade music, of course. This is a music that all came together in the days before the recording industry and radio, and so people were making their own music, right?
Well, yes. This was what people did for recreation from the early days of this country. When people got together for any kind of social event, there'd be music and there'd be dancing, and they would, you know, whether it's especially here in the mountains, if it was a barn raising or bringing in the crop or molasses making or whatever, those things would end with dances.
And were there other events that where these dances would? So you talked about a barn raising, maybe molasses making. How about were there sort of local civic celebrations, anything like that? Or when would you have this kind of event?
Well, at weddings, any time a community came together, there would be dances.
And the dances themselves, you know, the title of the book is Hoedowns, Reels, and Frolics. Reels, I take to be a kind of a dance. Hoedown and frolic is the place, is the event itself?
Well, the words are a little slippery because the meanings of these terms have changed over the years. When we talk about reels, we're basically talking about dances from the Scots-Irish tradition and Scottish tradition that came to this country with the Scots-Irish settlers. When we talk about hoedowns, that was originally basically talking about what we might think of today as clogging, getting out there and shuffling around with your feet in time to the music. And a frolic is a term that goes way back just to mean a dance party.
One of the additions to both Native American and African, or the contributions, I guess, was something called step dancing. And maybe you can talk a little bit about this, about how the dances were organized. If we think about dancing in partners or dancing separately, these were two different forms that come together in Appalachia, right?
Right. There's several different styles of dance or categories. They're what we would call set dances, where like a square dance where you and your partner dance with other couples. And then there are couple dances, which you might think of the waltz and two-step, but then also the one you refer to, step dances, would be what we'd think of as flat-footing and clogging, where you're making percussive noise and rhythm with your feet.
And tell us about the Native American contribution to this and the African American contribution to these dance forms.
Well, very, very early on, Cherokee folks were participating in the same kinds of dances, and they would do their own ceremonial dances, often in a ring form. But then they would also do the dances the Europeans were doing. And with intermarriage, there was a lot of trading back and forth. Here in Western North Carolina, some of the earliest clogging teams, back then called square dance teams, came out of Cherokee. So there were Cherokee dancers involved in those. And probably some of the movements in the square dances very likely come from the Native American tradition. The Black influence, I think, is the biggest story, the unknown, untold story. And it's that the African American folks adopted the European dances, but the practice of calling out the dance figures to prompt the dancers to do what they're supposed to do was not from the European tradition, and all of the earliest dance callers were African American. And so this was a way for African-Americans to do these dances without going to dancing school like the white people did.
Were they calling their own dances, or were they actually calling dances, for white dancers? Who was at those early dances when African-American callers were presiding?
Well, back in the early days, one thing I found that was amazing was that you go back to colonial times and you read about dances, the musicians are always black. If it's a public gathering. Now, sure, there were white fiddlers playing for family and friends, but if it was a public social event, chances are they were black. And those fiddlers played for the dancing schools that dancing masters were teaching the European dances, so they knew the figures, and then they would do the same dances in their own frolics on the plantations. So the idea, the innovation of calling out the figures ties in with the African tradition of call and response, and it's really a way to get the dancers to do something that they've never done before.
And you've just spotlighted one of the other interesting ways in which these cultural influences crossed in both directions. You talked about black fiddlers, and of course that would have been the fiddle, something they learned from their European counterparts, but what they brought to the table was the banjo, which is something they brought over from Africa, right?
Yes, that's true. However, one thing is that there was actually a fiddling tradition in Africa going back to the 13th century. So there were African fiddlers not playing the Italian instruments, but they had instruments that were bowed. So it wasn't that unusual for them to pick up the European fiddle in this country. And frankly, if you were enslaved and you knew how to play music, you wouldn't be working out in the fields, but you'd be playing for the dances in the big house, as seen in the recent film about Solomon Northrup, 12 Years a Slave. That's what he said was his salvation. He was a musician who played for the dances. But the banjo, as you mentioned, does have African roots, and we look at that nowadays as maybe a white mountain instrument, but it very clearly has African roots. Before being adopted by white people. And I see the dance calling and the banjo playing were both adopted by whites at about the same time in the mid-1800s.
And some of the steps as well, as we talked about earlier, so in the film Talking Feet, we hear a flatfoot dancer. We talked about flatfoot steps. D. Ray White, and we've got a clip of him explaining exactly what he's doing in this flatfoot dance.
D. Ray White first learned to flatfoot as a child around home in western West Virginia. Later, he picked up tap steps by watching traveling professional dancers. His dancing is mostly tap, with some flatfoot and some steps of his own. D. Ray dances with hand patting, singing, storytelling, talking blues, and of course, to music.
That's a clip of Mike Seeger's film Talking Feet. Flatfoot dancer D. Ray White was featured in that. Phil, talk a bit about the physical skills needed to learn these steps. Did kids pick it up pretty quick?
Well, the old saying is it's best caught, not taught.
I see.
So, basically go out to a place where there's music being played, watch what the other dancers are doing. They're shuffling their feet around. There's certain movements that people have in common. And that's really the best way to learn it. Nowadays, though, it is taught in a more formal setting. And it's, we talk about the roots and the branches of this dance. One of the branches is contemporary clogging, which is popular across the country. And you can certainly find lessons to do that.
I know this kind of thing still goes on, but I wonder if you'd tell us about the impact of the recording industry and radio on this whole cultural movement.
Well, one thing that I found fascinating in my research was that when they first started making recordings on 78s of this kind of mountain music, many of the recordings made in the late 1920s had people calling out the dance figures along with the music, because no doubt that must have been seen as just part of the music. And what I have found is, in thinking about it, these are people who had grown up calling before the days of recording, so they wouldn't have been influenced by other people from outside their region. And so I've listened to these calls and analyzed them and look at it as a little time capsule of the, you know, what dance figures were popular in different parts of the country at different times. And here in Western North Carolina, an amazing person is Samantha Bumgarner from Jackson County. And she was a banjo player and a dance caller. And in 1924, she was the first one to do this. She probably hopped on a train and went to New York City and made a few recordings calling out dance figures while she plays banjo at the same time.
We actually have a little bit of one recorded in 1927.
Big bring up and sparkle to your eyes.
Samantha Bumgarner and something from Big Ring, a 1927 recording called The Big Ring Dance. That must have been kind of a weird experience for somebody like her to be in a recording studio with a set of headphones on or an earpiece and calling this thing out.
Right. Well, actually, that was actually 1924.
Oh, that was 24. Okay.
I don't know if they used headphones back then, but... But it's quite amazing to hear that, and you know, you can picture that this is what the dances would have been like here in Western North Carolina in 1924.
Before they were influenced by again recording, so it must have become much more homogenized once people started listening to the radio.
Yes, and these early recordings are not intended to be able to be danced to. They were just looking at the calls as part of the music, and then later on in the 1940s, record companies started putting out recordings of dances that you could actually dance to, and that's when the big square dance movement started up that led into modern Western square dancing, where they do dance to records.
So what is the state of hoedowns, reels, and frolics today?
Well, it's a tradition that's still very much alive, though you have to know where to look. And there still are community dances out there, but they are few and far between. They're wonderful when you can find them. There's still lots of music being played, and anywhere there's music being played, people get out and shuffle their feet and dance a hoedown or flat foot or whatever. And there is a resurgence of interest among primarily young people across the country in the old-time square dances. So I've seen that, as I say, from Berkeley to Boston.
Well, if you think about from Berkeley to Boston, the number of regional variations that you might have found in 1924, has it become homogenized? Has it affected the number and the kind of regional variation that you might have found much earlier?
Well, that's true. It's the same as the music. You'll find people on the West Coast playing tunes from Surry County, North Carolina. So the music is available all over, and the dances are too. So yes, the dance tradition is somewhat homogenized now, and people don't think of these dances specifically as being from Western North Carolina or Kentucky or whatever. And that's part of what I've tried to do is locate where some of these dance styles came from.
And you point out that if we think of ourselves in this country as a melting pot, there is no better way to illustrate that than in this kind of dance. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, nobody would deny that square dancing is an American dance form. And I always think that, you know, if you ask what are other kinds of, quote, American dance forms or music, you know, you could think of jazz and rock and roll and swing and tap dance and go on down the list, bluegrass, etc. And every one of those has black influence. So I think it's pretty naive to think that American square dancing doesn't have black influence. And that's what I have tried to reveal in this book.
Phil, thank you so much. Great to talk with you.
Okay, thank you so much, Frank.
Phil Jamieson, nationally known dance caller, old-time musician, and flatfoot dancer. He's the author of Hoedowns, Reels, and Frolics, Roots and Branches of Southern Appalachian Dance. Going to read from the book tonight in Asheville at Malaprop's Bookstore at 7 o'clock. You can find out more information at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, more music. This, the acoustic world music of the duo, Joe Troop and Diego Sanchez, next on The State of Things. Stay with us.